in the limelight.
Climate and social justice campaigners on Thursday, November 12th, labeled the global summit bringing together over 450 public development banks a missed opportunity of historic proportions after the gathering concluded with no commitment to stop funding fossil fuel projects. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Andrea Germanis Ryder. This article is published under the heading, As Climate Crisis Rages, the World Public Banks Gathered at First Ever Summit and Chose to Not Rule Out Continued Fossil Fuels Funding. Here is the details of this article. Climate and social justice campaigners on Thursday, November 12th, labeled the global summit bringing together over 450 public development banks a missed opportunity of historic proportions after the gathering concluded with no commitment to stop funding fossil fuel projects. There is no excuse for the continued funding of billions of dollars in coal, gas, or oil projects. This must stop now, Sophie Richmond, a coordinator with Big Shift Global, said in a statement recently. The event in question was the four-day Finance in Common Summit, which ended on Thursday, November 12. The virtual summit was billed as a way to stress the crucial role of public development banks, PDBs, in reconciling short-term counter-cyclical responses with sustainable recovery measures that will have a long-term impact on the planet and societies. Institutions taking part included the World Bank, with hundreds of banks collectively managing over $2.3 billion in annual investments. As a source of funding for many large infrastructural projects, including in the energy sector, public development institutions are key to efforts to steer finance away from fossil fuels and into low-carbon projects, as Reuters noted. The summit produced a joint declaration which stated in part, On energy transition, we commit to increase the pace and coverage of investment in renewable energy, energy efficiency, and clean technologies to accelerate equitable access to clean energy and the energy transition. We will work together to leapfrog renewable energies into countries where there is little or no such development. We will support and promote sustainable alternatives to fossil fuel investments and consider ways and means of reducing these investments, contributing to the ambition of long-term low-carbon development trajectories and NDCs towards a decarbonized society. We will consider the range of fossil fuel investments in our portfolios, avoid stranded assets, and work towards applying more stringent investment criteria, such as explicit policies to exit from coal financing in the perspective of COP26. The declaration drew ire from progressive groups who lamented the absence of a bold commitment to full stop or propping up fossil fuel and the fact that the document wasn't even signed by all the participants. Without a concrete commitment to end public finance for fossil fuels, this summit can't be considered a success for climate action, said Laurie Vandenberg, senior campaigner at Oil Change International. It's too late for vague words about phasing out one fossil fuel at a time. Mark Futter, Defenders in Development campaign coordinator at the Coalition for Human Rights in Development, further accused the global meeting of having failed completely to address the legacy of PDB supporting projects linked to human rights abuses affecting thousands, if not millions, the world over. With no real commitments to community-led development, respect for indigenous people's rights, protection of defenders raising their voice around PDB finance activities, or a rights-based approach. More generally, he continued, any talk of inclusive development is just that, talk. The platform was an ideal opportunity for public development banks to stake out a roadmap for meaningful climate action towards COP26 in 2021, as well as raise the bar on other important issues such as human rights, said Petra Kejo, campaign manager at Recourse. However, she continued, a lack of ambition and time-bound commitments make the summit's joint declaration next to meaningless. It is particularly disappointing that multilateral development banks, such as the World Bank and Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, refused to make their engagement official by signing the declaration, said Kajol, calling the next 12 months building up to the next summit and COP26 critical for rectifying these mistakes. An end to PDB financing of fossil fuels was among the key demands from hundreds of organizations from the Global South, who said the COVID-19 pandemic, the global recession, and the intensification of climate change are pushing us deeper into unparalleled poverty and precarious existence. Public financial institutions control $2 trillion in public money and therefore wield enormous power, the group said in a joint statement. This power must be used not only to alleviate people's suffering and empower them to live humanely in these times of catastrophes, but also to build a new global order that is truly just, equitable, and gives primacy to the rights of people and the well-being of the planet. 450 of the world's biggest public development banks are meeting today. Scores of other U.S. and international groups, including Friends of the Earth Europe, via Campesina and the National Family Farm Coalition, also issued a joint statement on Thursday, November 12, accusing the development banks of being disconnected from any sense of what public means and any argument about what development should look like. In food and farming, the backbone of our very existence, they finance corporate agribusiness, the group said, and asserted that the time for PDBs had already come to an end. We need a very different approach to international finance that supports communities rather than companies and food systems free of corporate control, the groups wrote.
Hi everyone, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our episodes aim to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We'll try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspective from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will explore how people and government of Pakistan see and react to the normalization of relations with Israel.
The U.S. brokered agreement by the UAE and Bahrain to normalize relations with Israel has shaken the subcontinent. And Pakistan, that is home to one of the greatest Muslim populations in the world, was the scene of many days of protest against the Israeli regime and in support for the Palestinian cause. The heavy protests against the move, in which masses poured out to condemn and denounce the move, has given a clear message that despite all the pressure that Saudi Arabia might put on the Pakistani authorities, the common people of Pakistan will never let the government recognize Israel.
Following the announcement of the deal, Pakistan's foreign ministry issued a cautiously worded statement saying Islamabad has noted the joint statement announcing agreement with Israel. The ministry further muddled its message with ambivalent or obvious remarks, such as, this is a development with far-reaching implications and Islamabad's approach would be guided by its evaluation of how Palestinians' rights and aspirations are upheld and how regional peace, security and stability are preserved. The popular response was louder. Demonstrations against normalization of relations with Israel were held not only in the capital Islamabad, the port city of Karachi, or the northeastern city of Lahore, but also in Peshawar, Faisalabad, Multan, Hyderabad, and dozens of other cities and towns, as almost all the people were upset by the agreement.
We condemn the UAE. Moreover, peoples in the Muslim world now hate the UAE leaders. In a similar fashion, they hated Egyptian leader Anwar Sadat, who had normalized ties with Israel. Our message to the Arab leaders is that our hearts throb with our suppressed brothers and sisters in the occupied Palestine.
Most of the rallies were called by Mili Yakjehdi Council, a religious political alliance. The country's Jamaat-e Islami party observed the day as Palestine Day to express solidarity with the Palestinians and support the resistance against the illegal occupation. Senator Sirajul Haq, the party's chief who addressed the protesters in the city of Rawalpindi, said that no country has disgraced itself like the UAE during the last 70 years during which the Palestinians have been fighting for their land.
The government keeps reiterating that Pakistan has an abiding commitment to the full realization of the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people, including the right to self-determination. Imran Khan also said that his conscience will never allow him to accept Israel, which is responsible for so many atrocities against the Palestinian people. However, simultaneously saying that Pakistan will not recognize Israel until Palestinians get their rights shows a clear two-state solution policy. And Israel actually wants countries to aim for a two-state solution because it means recognizing Israel and denying the complete occupation of Palestine at the same time.
Prime Minister Imran Khan responded more unequivocally, saying that Pakistan's stance is very clear from day one, highlighting that father of the nation Muhammad Ali Jinnah had said Pakistan can never accept Israel until the people of Palestine get rights and state.
Hamara to mauqif bada clear hai aur hamara mauqif Qaid Azam Muhammad Ali Jinnah ne 1947 mein clear kar diya tha 1948 mein ki hum Israel ko kabhi taslim nahi kar sakte jab tak Palestinians ko unka haq nahi milta unko ek just settlement nahi hoti jo two nation theory thi Palestinian ki ki unko pura ek unki state mile jo ki Palestinian faisla kare theek hai.
His remarks were appreciated by the Palestinians, with the Embassy of Palestine saying, "We Palestinians consider Pakistan as our second homeland and Pakistanis as our dearest brothers who always supported Palestine on every forum of the world." The Premier also used the opportunity to talk about Kashmir.
Jab tak woh nahi hota, agar hum woh tasleem kar lete hain, to hame phir Kashmir ka bhi hame exactly situation Kashmir ka hai. تو ہمیں وہ بھی گیو اپ کرنا جانا چاہیے. تو اس لیے پاکستان نہیں تسلیم کر سکتا اسرائیل کو.
The deal was supposed to make Israel suspend its planned annexation of Palestinian lands, a concession welcomed by European and some pro-Western Arab governments as a boost for hopes of peace. But Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu stressed that Israel was not abandoning its plans to annex the Jordan Valley and Jewish settlements across the occupied West Bank.
Now, to add more insight and analysis, we are joined by Senator Mushahid Hussain Sayed. He is the chairman of Pakistan's Senate Foreign Affairs Committee. Senator, welcome to the subcontinent. So, we saw some Arab states normalizing their ties with the regime in Tel Aviv. Where does Pakistan stand in this and why?
Pakistan has a very strong and a very consistent position that Pakistan does not recognize Israel and does not accept Israel because it is a violation of United Nations resolutions. We are committed to a two-state solution, which includes a sovereign, independent state of Palestine with Jerusalem as its capital. And Pakistan's position on issue of recognition of Israel has been clear from day one, and we have always been in the forefront of solidarity and support for the Palestine cause.
Okay, so you're saying that the Pakistani government stands in solidarity and support for the Palestinian people, but how do the Pakistani people view this warming of ties with Israel?
The Pakistani people, by and large, feel that this warming of ties by certain countries in the Muslim world with Israel is an acquiescence to Israeli occupation, Israeli subjugation of Palestine, and something which is not acceptable. And this has been done at the behest of the United States of America and to earn their goodwill primarily. And this is more to view it in that context. And secondly, some of these Muslim states view Iran as a greater threat than Israel, a view that Pakistan and its people do not share.
Of course, Iran shares a great common history full of friendship with its neighbors, especially its immediate neighbors like Pakistan, and that's something many politicians in the West seem to detest. So how do you see these formalization of ties, and if we can say alliances, affecting the region, and if you see any impacts on them on the issue of Kashmir, which many described as another Palestine in the making?
Yes, Pakistan is very clear that any attempt to recognize Israel, which means recognition of Israeli illegal occupation of Arab territory, whether it's East Jerusalem, whether it's the Golan Heights, this is something which violates UN resolutions. And similarly, there are UN resolutions on Kashmir, which are similar to the UN resolutions on Palestine. So we feel in Pakistan that recognition or accepting Israeli hegemony, Israeli occupation, would also undermine Pakistan's principled stand on Kashmir, because the two issues are similar, and the two issues, Palestine in the Middle East and Kashmir in South Asia, are inextricably intertwined with the issue of peace, security, stability and justice in the region. So this is something which is not acceptable to Pakistan, and we reject this notion of recognition of Israel. And secondly, this also means that new coalitions are emerging in this region. Israel is a nuclear weapons state. Israel is backed by the United States. Israel has committed aggression against its neighbors, against other countries. So it will add to instability in the region, and it will make the region, which is already unstable, more volatile, and perhaps even lead to further destabilization, which is not a good omen for peace and security in the larger Muslim world and the Middle East region.
Senator, thank you so much for coming to our show and being with us.
You're welcome.
Now, let's see how people on social media reacted to this situation, and then we can continue with the rest of the segment.
At first, here are some pictures of the protests took place in Pakistan in condemnation of the UAE move to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. Shahid Reza quotes Muhammad Ali Jinnah as saying that the Muslims of India will help the Palestinians by all means.
at another level of discrimination against the Palestinians, C.J. Werlerman mentions that Twitter's action in suspending some of the pro-Palestinians accounts, especially those who demand international investigation into the Israel war crimes.
The diplomatic recognition of Israel by the UAE and Bahrain marks a shift in the Arabian Peninsula at large, as the two would not have done that without the tacit go-ahead of Saudi Arabia. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan gave a picture of Pakistan's policy in this regard. He said that the founding father of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, made clear in 1948 that we cannot accept Israel until Palestinians get their rights as per the two-state solution. But what does that mean?
Although Riyadh said it is not yet ready to have normal formal relations with Israel, Saudi Arabia was an enormous weight behind the deal. And because of the relations between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, there were speculations that Islamabad may follow the Arab states to normalize ties. Of course, Prime Minister Imran Khan quickly quashed such rumors, reiterating Pakistan's long-standing position that it won't normalize ties until there is a two-state solution to which the Palestinians agree. Over the last few decades, several senior Pakistani leaders of various political persuasions, such as Pervez Musharraf, Benazir Bhutto, and Shah Mahmud Qureshi, have called for ties with Israel. While in Turkey back in 2005, Israeli and Pakistani foreign ministers met publicly for the first time. There has also been reports of some covert cooperation in previous decades. In 2018, press reports surfaced that an Israeli jet landed in Pakistani airport, although the report was denied by Islamabad. The idea of Islamabad normalizing relations with Israel seems truly far-fetched at the moment, as the country is home to millions of Muslims who will not allow the US and Zionist interests destroy hopes for an independent Palestinian state.
At a time when Muslims need unity more than ever, there are people who benefit from fanning the flames of discord between Sunnis and Shias in Pakistan. The division is key in making sure that the enemy of the outside remains hidden while people brawl with each other over trivial issues. Critics say that Saudi petrodollars and support from Western intelligence agencies have made sure that Pakistanis remain divided and away from Iran, the neighbor which has stood firmly against Israel.
Pakistan, and especially the current government, has long sought to position itself as a neutral player in the complex rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran in the region. But considering the deep relationship with Riyadh, it does not seem likely. Supporting the normalization with Israel may have some potential benefits for Islamabad, including improved relations with the US and purchasing Israeli-made weapons, but can also get Pakistan mired down in an interconnected web of conflicting geopolitical forces. One of the apparent US objectives for the accord was to push back against Tehran by getting Saudi-aligned states, thus far UAE and Bahrain, to push closer to Iran's arch-nemesis Israel. However, the recent spat between Riyadh and Islamabad over Kashmir may scrap this goal. Pakistan is increasingly critical of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which is a Saudi-led group, for not doing more to bring attention to the Kashmir issue. Pakistan is also greatly disturbed by the policies of Riyadh and its friends with regard to India. Pakistan's long-standing conflict with India is an additional variable that must always be factored in when analyzing Islamabad's foreign policy. Moreover, the agreement between Iran and China, possibly Pakistan's closest ally, may also nudge Islamabad a bit closer to Tehran.
To learn more about this issue, we are joined by Mr. Abdullah Khan. He is the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Mr. Khan, welcome to the show. So, what can you tell us about the public opinion in Pakistan when it comes to some Arab countries warming of ties with Israel?
You know, the Pakistani people have long-standing certain views about Israel, because the occupation of Palestine by the Israel and the occupation of Kashmir by India is similar. and both are waiting to the resolution of that issues, both the issues. So generally what is happening in the Middle East, the Pakistani people have not a positive view about that, and they were actually shocked when this has happened, and it is happening on a rapid pace currently. It was generally disliked by the people of Pakistan, although there were some campaigns in Pakistan that we should recognize Israel, but they could not get any sort of general or popular attention of the people. So a certain, you can say, a very small fragment of our, you know, elite class, they were advocating that the Pakistan should also recognize Israel, but the, due to the sentiment and the people of Pakistan, Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan had to clarify that Pakistan is not going to accept Israel unless the issue of the Palestine is resolved. So generally, it is not a welcome step seen by the Pakistani people.
Okay, so you're saying that this issue is similar to the issue of Kashmir, and people don't support the normalization of relations. So what are the consequences of this normalization of ties with the Israeli regime on the issue of Kashmir?
You know that Israel and India, they are hand in glove in defense sector since long, and currently what is happening in Kashmir, a lot of Israeli support is there for the Indian soldiers, and they are supporting them, providing them state-of-the-art equipment to fire with the militants in Kashmir. So we have seen that Arab-Israel warming up of relations, and then we have seen that India also has very good relations with certain Arab countries, and they are further improving their relations with India. So perhaps in Pakistan, this development may not be seen as very good for the Pakistan stance on Kashmir. Already you have seen that the Pakistani foreign minister's stance vis-a-vis OIC regarding Kashmir issue was very, you know, a bitter statement was issued by Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi. And, you know, there was some sort of tension developed between Pakistan and Saudi Arabia on that statement. So that statement, to a large extent, that expresses the views of the people that we who see that what is happening in the Muslim world vis-a-vis Kashmir is not as much encouraging as it should be. So further warming up Israel-Arab ties will perhaps seen negatively by certain quarters in Islamabad and Pakistan, because more and more economic relations are now determining the relations between countries instead of moral grounds or you know, the laws, international laws and other things. So morality is perhaps being put on the back burner in the international relations, and economic ties, things related to money are actually matching a lot. So that is dictating the terms. Pakistan will have to look outside as well, how to balance that equation when Pakistan will further lose support on Kashmir, if Pakistan loses further support in the Middle East about the Kashmir issue.
All right, Mr. Khan, before asking the next questions, let's see the media views regarding this problem.
Pakistan has historically been very friendly with Saudi Arabia and the UAE due to many factors, including the presence of around 4 million of its expatriates in the two countries. In recent years, Pakistan's ties with Saudi Arabia have been adversely affected by Riyadh's softening attitude towards India's policies in Kashmir. In general, Pakistan's ruling establishment is frustrated by India's growing engagement with the Arab world, which has blunted traditional Arab support for Islamabad on matters related to Kashmir. Pakistan is one of Saudi Arabia's closest allies, while Riyadh has been a key player in softening Israel's image, a stance which contributed heavily to the recent signing of the so-called Abraham Accords between Israel, Bahrain and the UAE. The Saudi-Pakistan alliance is heavily leveraged, with the latter often beholden to the wishes of the kingdom due to Islamabad's current financial concerns.
Okay, so you earlier said that India and Israel support each other, and there's a lot of money playing a role in this. So would these normalizations change Pakistan's alliances in the region?
As I said earlier, that Pakistan will also have to look options to balance the current development. But there are certain very strong relations of Pakistan with certain Middle Eastern countries, and they are of strategic nature. So they will remain like that. Pakistan will have definitely tough time. Pakistan's stance is a principled stance regarding Palestine issue. So Pakistan cannot compromise that stance.
Mr. Khan, thank you for being with us. So let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Khalil Fawzi believes that normalizing ties with the Israeli regime is just betrayal to the Palestinians at any time. As a Bahraini activist, Maryam Al-Khawaja at first distinguishes between the government and the people of Bahrain and then concludes that the Bahrainis should be proud of their support for Palestine and standing against injustice. Robert Inlakesh believes that the unity of Muslims against the insulters of the Prophet Muhammad in France is a good example of how they should treat their enemies, and they need to follow the same pattern on the Palestine issue as well. Allama Rajan Nasir, by referring to Muhammad Ali Jinnah, believes that Palestine is only for Palestinians and the two-state solution is not acceptable at all.
And that was our episode covering the issue of normalization of ties with Israel and Pakistan's stance towards it. We'll meet next week.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to data from Johns Hopkins, the number of coronavirus infections in the U.S. increased by more than 136,000 between Tuesday and Wednesday, that is November 11th and 10th, while over 1,420 Americans died from COVID-19 during that time period, bringing the death toll to roughly 240,000. The U.S. is heading for a dark winter, a COVID hell, the darkest days of the pandemic. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, COVID-19 Soars to New Heights in the U.S. Here's the details of this article. I hope we don't run out of mobile morgues, is what epidemiologist Eric Figelding said in response to data demonstrating the out-of-control nature of the coronavirus pandemic in the United States of America, which became the first country to surpass 10 million COVID-19 infections, and whose healthcare system is expected to be overwhelmed. We are in an unbelievably dangerous moment with coronavirus where the full weight of governments at all levels needs to be focused on saving lives, tweeted David Dayen, journalist. As Dayen wrote in the American Prospect on Wednesday, November 11th, the world's worst coup attempt is going to get a lot of people killed. The figures are indeed harrowing. As CNBC reported on Wednesday, November 11th, Ohio has had an unprecedented spike in COVID-19 hospital admissions. ICU beds in Tulsa, Oklahoma are full. North Dakota's hospitals don't have enough doctors and nurses. And hospital administrators in Iowa are warning that they are approaching their limits. The U.S. is heading for a dark winter, a COVID hell, the darkest days of the pandemic. However you describe it, the next few months of the coronavirus pandemic will be unlike anything the U.S. has seen yet. According to data from Johns Hopkins, the number of coronavirus infections in the U.S. increased by more than 136,000 between Tuesday and Wednesday, that is November 11th and 10th, while over 1,420 Americans died from COVID-19 during that time period, bringing the death toll to roughly 240,000. Fielding expects the U.S. to hit 200,000 new cases per day by the end of November, if we continue this rate. This is incredibly worrisome to public health officials because, as The Atlantic reported recently, November 10th, there is already a nationwide surge of COVID-19 hospitalizations, which are now at an all-time high. We have not even come close to the peak, and as such, our hospitals are now being overrun. Michael Sternholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, told CNBC. The next 3 to 4 months are going to be by far the darkest of the pandemic, he said, who is member of Biden's Coronavirus Advisory Board. As Fielding pointed out on social media, deaths usually lag cases by about 3 weeks. Despite rhetoric offered by President Donald Trump about a plunge in the deadliness of the virus, the link between new cases, hospitalizations, and deaths has been consistent for months, The Washington Post reported on Tuesday, November 10th. Folks, with so many record highs, we are going to hit 200,000 new cases per day by the end of November. If we continue at this rate, deaths usually lag cases by 3 weeks. As Dayen put it, the executive branch has completely checked out on any responsibility for this massive public health crisis at precisely the moment when the crisis is most acute. Apart from attention to the election and its chaotic aftermath, Americans are also focused on upcoming holiday season, which Dr. Isaac Bogo, an infectious disease specialist at the University of Toronto, said creates the potential for innumerable super-spreading events across the country that could introduce and reintroduce the virus to new areas and further exacerbate community transmission. Pandemic fatigue has fully set in at the worst possible time, Dayen said. Nonetheless, public health officials are still pushing for more people to wear masks, which they predict can prevent up to 130,000 deaths from COVID-19 in the U.S. through spring 2021. Looking beyond masks, we know exactly what to do here, which is what makes the federal government's inaction so frustrating, Dayan argued. Restaurants, gyms, cafes, and indoor venues accounted for 80% of all new infections during the first 3 months of the pandemic, based on cell phone data, he wrote. If we just shut down these venues and pay them to stay closed, we would get a shockingly large handle on the situation, Dayan pointed out. Yet, we've had absolutely no discussion of this in the highest levels and no leadership in Washington looking seriously at this option. It's absolutely infuriating that we are going to consign people to death and suffering, he added, because nobody in the White House or Congress can be bothered.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense. A new model for the presence of the people in the arena of Sacred Defense and the cultivation of talents.
There are many books and movies about various wars, and we have read many of them, but such popular cooperation and assistance is completely unprecedented in the world. For example, such and such a young man from a village in such and such an area of the country, for example, a village in Kerman, would go to the city and would join the forces and later he would become a personality like Haj Qasim Soleimani. So, a great movement was in place. Such and such a young student decided to join the front lines without having previously held a gun in their hands. And amid the war, he became an outstanding and influential figure in a very strategic military base in the space of a year and a half. For example, we could cite a youth who worked as a journalist in a certain newspaper and who later on would join the front lines, turning into a personality like Shahid Hassan Bakhri, a genius in the area of military intelligence in less than no time.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
There was no shortage of such astonishing phenomena. Talents were cultivated, and eternal personalities and great martyrs were born in the war, some of whom I mentioned. I used to see some exemplary young officers, notably Shahid Sayyad, whom I knew from early revolutionary days. I think that at that time he was a young officer with the rank of a lieutenant or a captain. He was in contact with me and we used to see each other. However, he turned into an experienced and competent commander, able to guide and command the ground force of the Islamic Republic of Iran army for a long time and to participate in the most daring endeavors. The same is true of Shahid Babai and others. This innovative model of popular presence could always be employed. Today too, we can benefit from this model.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. This is not the children's program. This is the voice of my doll. When I was six, my father, who used to serve in the military, brought me a souvenir in one of his missions in Qasr-e-Shirin in western Iran. Oh, how much I loved the doll. Still love it. Dolls are not just toys. They are cultural signs that interconnect between cultures. Today I'm going to take you to an exciting place, to the International Dolls Museum in Tehran. The International Dolls Museum, which is a private museum, was established in Tehran in 2014 by the joint efforts of two collectors. Later on, enthusiasts expanded the museum by donating their old, historical, and special dolls to the museum. There are more than 2,000 culturally diverse dolls from 80 different countries around the world showcased in the museum. These dolls are categorized in this museum by the continent in order to represent the Iranian culture from the Elami to Qajar, Iran. This museum also showcases sculptures of men and women with beautiful traditional outfits. I am now at the beginning of Saadi Shomali Avenue. In the alley next to me, there is an old building. Well, I suppose it's here. Yes, I'd better ring the bell. من میترا هستم از رادیو انگلیسی. قبلا باهاتون هماهنگ کرده بودم.
بله، بفهمید.
عروسک هایی که سالیان سال در پستوی خانه های گلی توسط مادرها و مادر بزرگها.
I am now in a small movie theater. Upon my arrival at the museum, a 10-minute video will be played. This video is about some very old dolls. Dolls like Daruma, Japan's wishing doll, Matryoshka doll, symbol of Russia, Nutcracker doll from Germany, and some other cute dolls. Each has an interesting story. Oh, incredible! All these dolls in a chamber. How pretty these dolls are! Dolls with different races and ethnicities, with different beliefs, with different myths, and with beautiful and special costumes of each region. Oh, look at here! Puppets! The curator of the museum told me that the visitors are allowed to touch the puppets and move them. I always liked to see these puppets since I was a child. It's a unique experience. Well, look at here. Colorful dolls made of corn leaves, apple, cloth, string, and wood. Each doll has been brought here from kilometers away and has its own story. These dolls are from Germany, Africa, Mexico, Japan, China, Georgia, Nepal, Afghanistan, Armenia, Austria, and many different countries. Some of these dolls are specially made for ritual ceremonies. For example, this Tajik doll, which has no face. Well, This is from Mazandaran province in Iran and is special for a ceremony of appealing rain from God. And here it's the smallest doll in the museum. This doll comes from Guatemala. Mother and father gave the doll to their children and told them, "When you go to sleep, tell all the griefs to your doll and then put it under your pillow." The next morning, the parents took out the doll, and when the kid woke up, his or her parents said, "The doll has removed all your griefs." Oh, what a beautiful story. Made me cry. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Around the World with Reporters.
On September 17, a resolution issued by the European Parliament urged EU member states to impose an arms embargo on Saudi Arabia over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Yemen war. The resolution also contained an arms embargo on Cairo and Ankara, motivated by concerns Europeans' arms and military equipment might be used for internal repression in Egypt, and that Turkey's conduct in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea would run counter to the sovereignty of any EU member state. While some EU countries such as Germany, Finland, and Denmark have adopted restrictions on the arms exports to Riyadh, Italy and other EU nations have ignored the resolution in full so far.
It's unacceptable that Egypt, a country known for human rights abuses, is the top importer of Italian weapons across the world. Saudi Arabia follows. We can't accept that countries involved in wars continue to receive our military equipment. Unfortunately, Italy hasn't done much since the EU Parliament adopted the resolution.
An Italian government report has found that the Unit for the Authorizations of Armament Materials green-lighted 57 times last year the supply of military systems, including bombs, torpedoes, rocket launchers and missiles, worth about 200 million euros to Saudi Arabia and UAE.
One in four arms sold worldwide in 2019 were produced in Europe, according to a report by CIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. France and Germany topped the list of European countries that trade in arms, while Italy came third.
We often look at the US as the main arms supplier worldwide. However, we forget that Europe also plays a major role. If the European Parliament only issues resolutions and not directives, all those countries not observing arms embargo cannot be sanctioned. Furthermore, there is a lack of political will among EU countries for change. European companies even compete with one another to sell more arms in conflicting countries.
Consecutive Italian governments have also ignored a domestic law passed in 1990 which bans the exports of weapons in countries in a state of war. Italy's arms exports stood at over 5 billion euros in 2019. Max Civili, Rome.
The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela has strongly rejected a round of one-year-long sanctions fired by the European Union, which challenges the legitimacy of the upcoming legislative elections in the Latin American nation. Nicolas Maduro made the remarks after the EU's European Council condemned a decision by the Supreme Court of Venezuela to reshuffle the composition of the country's National Electoral Council. Maduro said the move by the European body is influenced by the regime change policy of the United States, which refuses to recognize Maduro's presidency and the country's legal institutions. The Venezuelan head of state said the elections will take place despite the economic sanctions because they follow the rule of the national constitution. Officials totally back Maduro's statement.
The EU sanctions are a violation of international law and therefore we absolutely repudiate them. From a different perspective, many opposition members justify the EU policy.
From a different perspective, many opposition members justify the EU policy. However, experts say the EU sanctions